Good afternoon and welcome to our conversation today. My name is Mary Thoreau. I'm Chairman and CEO of the Independent Institute. Today we're going to be discussing our new book, Beyond Homeless, Good Intentions, Bad Outcomes, Transformative Solutions. And we're delighted to have several of the contributors with us today. I first got involved in homelessness several years ago when I was serving on the San Francisco Salvation Army Board. And we were doing some strategic planning and decided that homelessness was an area we could have a very positive impact in. So we formed a task force to start developing some programs. As a researcher, I was asked to give the board a briefing on why homelessness was such a crisis here. So I started looking into it. And the more I looked into it, the less sense it made. The city of San Francisco spends hundreds of millions of dollars a year on homelessness, and the problem just keeps spiraling out of control. At the same time, it was said that housing was the solution, but San Francisco has more per capita permanent supportive housing than any other city, with 10,000 people currently living in it. And yet, two-thirds of the annual drug overdose deaths are taking place in that housing. So it doesn't seem to be resolving the problem. So that's when we decided we should turn to our experts and researchers and ask them to delve into the problem more deeply, into the real causes that are driving homelessness, and more important, what are solutions that we could suggest be adapted to solve it? So several of the people we've been working with are with us today. Scott Ackerson is a licensed master social worker whose 30-year career has spanned enhancing child welfare, enabling young adults to exit the foster care system, developing and operating homeless and behavioral health programs, and promoting affordable housing. He served at the Haven for Hope campus, which we highlight in our work and will be discussing later today, for many years. And he currently serves as director of the Social Impact Studio at West East Design Group. Chris Colton is the research fellow in housing and homelessness at the Independent Institute. He received his PhD in history at the University of Florida. And in addition to being a contributor to the book under discussion today, Dr. Colton's recent articles on homelessness and housing and related issues have been published in the San Francisco Chronicle, the Washington Examiner, Los Angeles Daily News, San Diego Union Tribune, and others. Jonathan Hofer is research associate at the Independent Institute, where he writes extensively on California and national public policy. In addition to his contribution to today's book, Jonathan has recently co-authored a policy report fact-checking Governor Newsom's claim that red states have higher crime rates than blue, as well as Mondami's campaign promises for housing for New York. Lawrence McQuillan is a senior fellow and director of the Center on Entrepreneurial Innovation here at the Independent Institute. He received his PhD in economics from George Mason University and has written extensively on California's housing crisis and its solutions, how to resolve the looming unfunded pension crisis, wildfires, and more. His opinion pieces have appeared in news outlets across the country, including the Orange County Register, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and the Wall Street Journal. Delighted to have you here today. We'll have a conversation for 30 to 40 minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions from our audience. So Lawrence, as Kai Reisdahl says, let's do the numbers. Just how bad a crisis is homelessness?
Well, thank you, Mary, and thank you to everybody who is participating in today's discussion about an extremely important topic. It's bad, and it's probably worse than what most people think. Even though, you know, a lot of people assume that it's a big problem, I think the numbers are unfortunately growing, and I think they tell a story that what we're doing currently isn't working. So I've tried to break this down into national and then California and then within California, just to give it some context. because it is such a big issue that spans coast to coast. So I thought I'd kind of try to make it so it's more comprehensible to everybody. So nationally, the most recent numbers is there's 771,000 people experiencing homelessness across the country. That's a 12% increase from the previous survey number. So it's not getting any better, unfortunately. California's number is about 187,000 people experiencing homelessness. So it's about 25 to 30% of the national total is in California. And to put that in perspective, California has about 12% of the U.S. population. So we have a disproportionate impact on the homelessness problem in California. Looking at the Bay Area, for example, I've jotted down a few numbers here from recent years. So this is from 2017 to 2022. San Francisco's homelessness went up 20%. California's went up 28%. The Bay Area, which is the nine counties surrounding the San Francisco Bay, went up 36%. San Jose is up 53%, and Oakland is up a staggering 83%. And this is just over the last five or so recent fiscal years. So as you can see, the numbers keep going up. Nobody, I think, in California can say they have a handle on the problem because the numbers keep increasing. And so it tells a story, obviously, of we're spending a lot more money on the problem, and yet the problem isn't diminishing any, in especially in California.
Thank you. Scott, as a licensed master social worker, you've spent decades working with probably thousands of people experiencing homelessness, so can tell us probably better than anyone, what does cause homelessness?
So there's a myriad of things that cause homelessness, and that's why our approach in many ways is not working. Homelessness is not a homogeneous phenomena, so we can't expect homogeneous intervention to solve it. The causes of homelessness range from, you know, the commonly quoted ones, addiction, mental illness. But if you look at the stats for people exposing homelessness, one study, over 90% of females experiencing homelessness have been victims of violence, and 65% of females experiencing homelessness were sexually abused before their fifth birthday. So you've got histories of trauma, violence. It can be medical bills. It can be economic homelessness. So there's a myriad of reasons, and that's why a single approach to intervene is not working.
So a lot of people cite the point in time count. So just to explain, maybe you could explain the point in time count and what it shows and why that might not be the best source of data.
So the point in time count is conducted the last 2 weeks of January per HUD, the COC. It's required for every continuum of care. And you use the homeless management information system and deploy people out to the streets to count people experiencing homelessness. The methodology is lacking at best. One, HUD has a definition of homeless as real homeless, so people that are doubled up, tripled up, don't count as homeless. It's only people that are on the street or in a shelter. So the numbers are typically skewed, and then the fact that it's done in the last two weeks of January, it's very cold across the United States in many places, so people will find some sort of refuge, so we really can't count on those numbers. The good thing about those numbers, at least it gives us a baseline and somewhere to start, but we really need to be more comprehensive on how we're doing it. Such as McKinney-Vento, they count children that are homeless in the school systems, and they count families that are doubled up and tripled up. So the point in time count doesn't really give us an accurate reflection of the number of people experiencing homelessness on an annual basis.
But it goes beyond just the count. It's also used to gather attempt to interview people who are experiencing homelessness and ask them, you know, why are you homeless? So it's cited often on, what percentage are homeless for different reasons. Is that very accurate?
Self-reports are sometimes sketchy at best. I've done now probably 18 points in time count here locally in San Antonio, Texas. And I mean, you're getting somebody who's trying to go to sleep, or so I don't think we're always going to get accurate information from doing the interviews of that, like that. And then particular to people on the street, like in San Antonio, we've got, you know, about 3,000 people experiencing homelessness. We're not going to be able to interview 3,000 people in a single evening or a single night. So the data can be a little skewed, and sometimes it gets a little skewed because most of the interviews are happening with the unsheltered homeless.
Yeah. Well, most of us don't take self-reported data a great deal of worth, but it's interesting that it is used by many people to cite, oh no, only this percentage are, you know, homeless because of this, and this percentage are homeless because of this. So, but it's, I guess, the best thing we have other than accounts from people who work daily with the homeless in the streets and can help us better understand the issue at a more individual level than these big surveys. Chris, I mean, over and over again, we're told that housing causes homelessness. Is that accurate?
It has a grain of accuracy to it. The problem with it is, as Scott's already kind of addressed somewhat, is it becomes a monocausal explanation for homelessness, and that's the problem. So the way I always break it down is you have two perspectives when you're looking at causes in social phenomena. You have the aggregate, the macro level perspective, where you look at cities or states. And in that level, housing prices do track more closely than any other factor with higher rates of homelessness. They correspond relatively well. So it's not a factor we can dismiss, and we don't want to deny that that's a part of the puzzle. But at the micro level, like, what are the factors that make an individual more likely to fall into homelessness? As Scott's already mentioned, mental illness and substance abuse are probably the two biggest factors that go into that, especially when we look at unsheltered homelessness. Among the unsheltered homelessness, rates of substance abuse and mental illness, they vary from survey to survey, but they range into the 70%+. It's a predominant trait among the unsheltered. So we can't ignore those just by looking at the macro level factor of housing. We have to look at the whole picture.
Right, but some of the substance abuse is a result of becoming homeless, just to be clear, and not perhaps the cause of what put someone into homelessness in the first place. It's my understanding.
There may be some truth to that. I think the instances of somebody who has not developed any substance abuse problem becoming homeless and then becoming an addict is probably relatively rare. It's hard to determine this question because of self-report surveys, as you've mentioned. We do see people increasing substance abuse, drug use, once they become homeless. And there is also reports of people, once they get placed in housing, voluntarily decreasing the rate of substance abuse. There was a New York article that quoted a woman in permanent supportive housing who said, well, when I was on the streets, I did heroin because I needed to. Now I only do heroin when I want to, right? And so she was saying she doesn't do it as often, but her addiction was not caused by homelessness. So the direction of causality is important there. And primarily, I think we do find substance abuse causing homelessness more frequently than the other way around, to the best that we can identify it from the imperfect evidence.
Okay. Scott, did you want to add anything on that?
Looking at the impact of trauma, so the stats I cited on females experiencing homelessness, if you think about it, a child that's sexually abused before the age of 5 typically is removed from their home, typically has multiple placements. The trauma is really never fully addressed, and then they turn 18 and suddenly they're supposed to be a functional adult. But during that time, that untreated trauma can lead to self-medication, which then leads to addiction issues. So it's kind of all of these social factors that are compounded by each other.
All right. Thank you. So the subtitle of the book is Good Intentions, Bad Outcomes, Transformative Solutions. So how have well-intentioned policies exacerbated the crisis? Scott, I'm going to start with you, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about Hearth and Housing First.
Sure. So during the Obama administration, a change was made. Emergency shelter grant was changed to the emergency solution grant, and they repurposed all of the funding that used to go to emergency shelters and repurposed it for permanent housing options only. So an unintended consequence of that is most cities across the United States either downsized or eliminated their emergency shelter. So housing first, the policy, it's a great policy, but you have to have several things in play to make it work. One, you have to have housing capacity, which particularly most urban centers do not have. And I'm doing more and more work in smaller cities and rural environments, and we're starting to see the same phenomena there. So if you don't have the housing capacity, and then the second component of that is the capacity for supportive services. So the HUD funding in and of itself doesn't provide that type of capacity. And again, Housing First is a great model, but if you don't have the right tools to make the model work, it's not going to work. So you can't put somebody in the throes of addiction and mental illness into an apartment and do a once a week or once a month home visit and expect that their situation is going to improve.
Right. As I cited here in San Francisco, we see the 2/3 of the 700 to 800 annual overdose deaths are happening in permanent supportive housing. So it's, and people are dying at a higher rate housed than they are when they're still out in the streets. So it's a problem.
Yeah. So the other unintended consequence of that, and that's what I see as a key contributor to the increase in unsheltered homeless, is when you eliminated that funding that went to shelters, the organizations had to pivot and figure out how they were going to retain their funding. So many of them went into permanent housing. So now if you find yourself unhoused, in many cities, the only option that you have is the street because emergency shelter beds are lacking.
Right. Jonathan, the other sort of monolithic policy that's been adopted almost everywhere is called harm reduction. Can you explain to us what that is, what it's intended to do, and what we've seen actually happen?
Yeah, certainly. Thank you. And I think that's a very appropriate way of characterizing it as a monolith, at least in the way that people talk about it. Harm reduction is effectively an umbrella term that describes a series of policies, strategies, and programs that can be loosely contrasted with abstinence-only programs. So those would be programs and services where cessation of drug use or sobriety would be a requirement for participation. The Drug Policy Alliance and other harm reduction organizations that bill themselves as harm reduction activists would include strategies such as needle exchange or syringe services, supervised consumption sites, which are areas where you can take pre-obtained drugs and consume them with medical supervision. It could also include adulterant screening, whereas you can also take pre-obtained drugs and have it tested for things that could potentially lead to an overdose. It could be provision of paraphernalia. What we see in San Francisco and increasingly elsewhere is the provision of aluminum foil, if not strictly aluminum foil, then a foil-like substance. And the idea behind these strategies and others is that harm reduction would be a minimally invasive intervention that buys drug users enough time to seek out recovery service themselves, or at the very least mitigates harm done through the course of using intravenous drugs or other like consumables, inhalants, things like that. It is a little bit of a tricky subject to talk about because, as I said, people treat it as a monolith, and you really need to subdivide these strategies and consider them independently. Harm reduction does have some marked successes. If we look at things like rates of transmission of HIV, bloodborne diseases such as hepatitis C and B, those are reduced at a considerable amount. It reduces soft tissue infections. It leads to, or we see in some pilot programs, especially in the Bay Area, the cost to taxpayers is considerably lower, because if someone overdoses, they're entered into the general medical care system, ambulances are called and so forth. So that's at a cost lower to the public. However, it needs to be properly practiced, because if you don't practice it correctly, you're leaving people behind and people are slipping through the gaps. And so if it's not practiced in such a way that you're giving people room to seek out recovery, you're effectively abandoning them to the streets. And that's unfortunately what we see when things aren't done well. We could also take San Francisco, for example. If you go to some sites, especially syringe exchange programs, there may be no opportunity for individuals to actually seek care. And when you do that, you're leaving them to their own devices. And then when you see local politicians, recount that they have lots of public services available, you're assuming that individuals have the capacity to kind of navigate that thicket of recovery services, and it's not very viable to people. People who are especially sensitive, or people who are the most endangered on the streets, they don't have a lot of great means to get transportation, secure long-term medical care. And if you don't have a sorting system such as Haven for Hope, your treatments and therapies could be like splintered and fractured across a number of organizations, services. This is especially true with individuals who have an additional mental illness in addiction to just kind of a substance use disorder. So for example, someone has some kind of psychiatric condition like schizophrenia, that would not be appropriate to treat them in the same way that someone with alcoholism would be treated. So in short, it does have some marked improvements, but it needs to be done appropriately.
I think what we see in practice a great deal is, as you noted, is paraphernalia is distributed. And again, I can see the health justification for giving clean needles to not transmit disease, but one wonders what health benefits providing foil is is giving people. And continuing to use fentanyl is not a long-term viable pathway. And we're hearing that recovery is never mentioned whatsoever.
Right. And actually, to your point about FOIL, because that's actually an interesting case. The original idea behind distributing FOIL is that people use it in a process we refer to as cooking. So that'd be altering the state of their substances to usually make it easier to consume, or it can be used as a container for intravenous drugs, or sometimes you proliferate it with another vessel to make a makeshift pipe. So the idea was that it's preferable to give people foil because they could at least ignite it and inhale it, and that would make overdose less quick. The onset would be less quick, and you'd be able to respond with overdose agents more effectively. However, what we've seen in San Francisco is that some substances, especially fentanyl, actually stick to the foil. And so the residue actually builds up and increases the likelihood of fatal overdoses, which is incredibly tragic. Yeah. And I think it's quite illustrative of the good intention, bad outcome.
It also is worth mentioning that's been the cause of a lot of overdose deaths among children who have gotten their hands on contaminated foil.
Mm. Chris, while we're with you, How is our housing policy, both locally and nationally, contributing to the problem?
National housing policy doesn't move the needle very much either way, because housing policy is primarily a local and secondarily a state matter. But it does contribute to the problem. As I mentioned earlier, housing costs do correlate with higher rates of homelessness across cities. And where we find lower housing costs, we find more liberal zoning policies, ministerial permit policies, And if things of this nature that lead to more market rate housing from private developers without all of these subsidies. What we have in California, the problem is twofold. One is we have such high regulation on housing that housing costs have just gone through the roof over the past 30 years in California. And as a corollary of that, under Housing First, all of the money that goes into Housing First is to subsidize housing, and it's just eating up all of these resources in our homelessness budgets. So we're spending tons of money on homelessness in California. We're seeing the problem get worse anyway, and at least part of that is because we're subsidizing housing in a market where we're a strangled housing market. So it's taxpayer dollars chasing the effects of government regulations. It's a vicious cycle of increasing costs without corresponding benefits.
Yeah, the list of details of what permanent supportive housing has to include is just astounding, and how it has to be built is just astounding. And it's in California now, we're spending $800,000 to $1 million per unit of permanent supportive housing. So it just... It's mind-boggling and certainly producing bad outcomes. Okay, but we promised the topic of today was going to be what really works to end homelessness. So let's shift to models that do work and then recommendations for helping extend those models and promote real solutions. Scott, I'm going to start with you because you have real-world experience. You were at Haven Hope for Hope for 10 years or more. You changed its model to make it much more effective. And could you tell us about that program?
So Haven for Hope, it's a 22-acre campus, and we don't consider it a homeless shelter. We consider it a transformational campus. Mm. So it opened in 2010, which is exactly when the feds changed their policy around funding on emergency shelter. So as near as I can tell, while most communities across the United States were downsizing or eliminating emergency shelter due to the Hearth Act and the repurposing of the funds, San Antonio spent $100 million to make this mega campus. The original model of the campus was behavior modification, which having worked years in residential treatment for children, I know it works in a controlled environment, but it doesn't impact the reasons that you're there. So over the first several years of the program, we transformed the program, utilizing then emerging evidence-based practices, now evidence-based practices, trauma-informed care, person-centered approach, so there's not a one-size-fits-all. Everybody has their own plan that they're a part of developing. We don't develop the plans for them. We did an 18-month peer support integration, so when Haven opened, 0% of the staff were people with shared experience. Now about 30% of the staff are people with shared experience. So we made a lot of those changes. And so the campus was very successful in providing a place for people not only to get off the streets, but to get their multitude of needs met. We took about 60, 65 service providers that were scattered throughout the city and brought them directly onto the campus so people had easy access to services. So the campus was a huge factor in reducing unsheltered homeless. Unsheltered homeless downtown San Antonio has gone down by 80-85%, partly because of Haven. The other thing that we don't often talk about when we talk about the campus, it's not just the campus that made the impact. It was the campus, but it also, my first 5 years there, I was working internally on programming. My second 5 years there was more around the community work. So what we found is that everything was still in silos, including the service providers. Many had different modalities of treatment and how they handle people experiencing homelessness. So we're able to get 60, 70 service providers all sort of rowing in the same direction toward outcomes. But more importantly, we help to organize the community systems. So oftentimes it's not outreach workers or homeless service providers that encounter people experiencing homelessness. It's PD, EMS, and others. So they have to be a part of the solution. So we really did more of a multi-sector intervention that includes the hospital systems, EMS, PD, universities, nonprofits. So it really has to be a multi-sector community systemic approach. It can't just be a shelter that's going to solve the problem.
I have to say, when I was there filming our companion documentary, Beyond Homeless, Finding Hope, it was several years ago, and it's when this big chill was moving into Texas, and they were expecting sub-freezing weather, and the Haven for Hope put out a press release that the media carried widely, saying that they were opening up the campus to anybody who was on the street and needed a warm place to be. And then simultaneously that they were, since they were going to have this inflow of people seeking shelter, they were going to need sleeping bags and coats and other things. And the line of cars that came by with people unloading, they'd gone shopping with new sleeping bags, new coats, hats, gloves. I mean, you truly do feel in San Antonio that the whole community feels ownership of Haven and feels pride in Haven. And you have, 1,000 volunteers on campus every month working and so on. So, I mean, we found programs everywhere in the country that work very well. Some serve, you know, a few people, and some serve 100 people or more. But Haven's the one that I am just so struck by, and the reason we feature it so prominently in the documentary, because it is the entire community working together in kind of a virtuous circle, and effectively working together, and then it feeds back out into the community. So I'm just incredibly impressed by it. Our book also wraps up with solution policy recommendations that would help move the scale on this crisis and hopefully reverse it from what we're seeing to actually making gains, which would be a nice thing to do. So I'm just going to go around to each of you, and maybe you could talk about your, you know, the policy recommendations that you've contributed to in this work. So, Lawrence, should we start with you?
Sure. So my recommendation would be to stop measuring success by dollars spent, because that hasn't worked, and start actually evaluating programs and seeing which ones have the best success rates in terms of getting people back on their feet and contributing again to society. And so I would recommend that we do a real deep dive into the success of these programs that are receiving millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases of taxpayer assistance, and fund those that are actually getting the job done and getting people back on their feet. About 40% of San Francisco's Department of Homelessness and Supportive Services budget gets funneled through straight to nonprofit service providers. And they've done a very poor job of evaluating which programs are working and which aren't. And I think that's a great example of how not to do things, and that we need to get more serious about evaluating these programs and putting the money into the ones that are having actual successes.
I think half of San Francisco's homelessness budget goes to permanent supportive housing, so it just goes to the people who are currently being warehoused. But they're going to be warehoused for their entire lives. There's no expectation. It's permanent supportive housing. There's no expectation that anything will change, that their lives will improve, that they can possibly achieve a higher state than to be living in government-subsidized housing with their addictions, with their problems, and so on. So it's not only a tragic waste of money, but a tragic human outcome as well. And then, Lawrence, tell us a little bit of, I think there was an audit, was it this year or last year, about where California's money is going and what results it's achieving?
Right. Yeah. And this was done by the Interagency Council on Homelessness, California's Interagency Council on Homelessness. And they wanted to do a full audit on where government money is going, how many programs say that they're assisting homeless people. And it turns out, I think it's 35 programs overall that provide direct assistance to people experiencing homelessness. in California. Over 3 fiscal years alone, they spent $9.5 billion. These programs over just 3 fiscal years, over 5 to 6 fiscal years, they spent about $21 to $24 billion. So just a massive amount of money is being spent by a lot of different agencies. And up until that point, nobody actually knew where this money was going. And so that's a start, is to figure out where the money is going and how it's being spent. But obviously it's not doing anything in terms of bringing down the numbers when we have, you know, 187,000.
And again, the report showed that there's no strategy for how it's
right,
being spent.
Right. And there's no oversight.
Chris, let's move on to you. What recommendations would you have for helping make the problem actually better?
The biggest point I always like to make is that you need an institutional environment that allows for a plurality of solutions. So the debate often gets captured by these policy binaries, right? We had the treatment first or housing readiness approach under the Clinton administration that switched to the housing first approach under the Obama administration, and as well as George W. Bush, that was a little bipartisan. And so we have this binary between these two different approaches, but they both had gaps in them where there were certain people whose needs weren't met. The first Housing First study by Sam Semberis in 1999, I believe, acknowledged that people who went through the Treatment First program had about a 47% success rate where they became independent and self-sustaining. That was the measure of success under Treatment First. And he did Housing First experiment focusing specifically on people with diagnosed mental illnesses. In other words, people that likely couldn't become independent because of their illness, and he changed his measure of success to housing stability under permanent supportive housing, right? So under Treatment First, people like these people with mental illnesses were kind of left by the wayside. And under Housing First, people who can become self-sustaining, as you mentioned, Mary, are being made permanent wards of the state. There's permanent supportive housing for teens in California, which is very depressing when you think about it, the idea that teens have to be permanent wards of the state. So between the two of them, it is worth mentioning that homelessness was going down nationally under the Treatment First model, and that trend reversed under Housing First. But the one-size-fits-all policy approach, I think, is the bigger problem, because homelessness, as Scott mentioned, is a complex, multifaceted issue. Every homeless individual is homeless for different reasons, and they have different needs to help them escape homelessness. And so you need an institutional environment that allows for a plurality of solutions. And that's generally found in solutions to social problems go, that's generally found through privatization and decentralization. When you make it more localized, cities can experiment with different approaches.
Yeah, social entrepreneurship. Yeah. Let people develop different models and let the winners attract the resources that help them grow and thrive. Jonathan, any recommendations in the...
Mine's very similar to Chris's in that not only do you not have much of a laboratory of innovation, but you actually have a thicket of top-down service providers, typically through a municipal government, and that is incredibly difficult to navigate if you're actually seeking help. So if you have services that are completely scattered, incapable of communicating with one another, how are you supposed to get help if you need, like, let's say, child care and maybe some counseling for a substance use disorder? You can't, because those are totally separate systems and the two don't cross. You need a sorting mechanism that enables people to get bespoke treatment for whatever they're dealing with. And to that point, we mentioned in the book, there is room also, I think, for revising how we do jail diversion and also civil commitments. California for a long time has had reasonable prohibitions on indefinite civil commitments. Of course, we don't want that. And we also don't want people committed who shouldn't be committed at all. However, there are some people who, if they do get involved with law enforcement, that could be an important point of intervention to make sure that they receive the care that they deserve. And if we don't have that, then you have a lot of people get lost in the gaps. So what California has done over the last couple of years has done a pilot program for what they call care courts. These are not traditional jail diversion programs. These are kind of a revision to civil commitments, and they enable people to report their loved ones who they believe are incapable of caring for themselves or a danger to others. And then that provides an opportunity to check up on them. I think stuff like that in concert with bespoke treatment for substance use disorder and mental health issues is a very important combination that city governments don't presently have.
Great. Thank you. So we're going to go to questions now. And we have a couple from some of our local friends, one of whom is asking about, we were talking when we released the documentary several years ago, and the documentary talks about early efforts here in San Francisco. Again, I was working with the Salvation Army on their hopes to redevelop. They own several properties in the city, and we had hoped we'd be able to redevelop those into residential transformational programming with recovery, workforce development, life skills training. We ran smack dab up against the bureaucracy, which is the city of San Francisco, in terms of being able to do any redevelopment. And it really sort of shocked me, because I thought, if we go to the city of San Francisco and say, we would like to invest a whole lot of money into programs that can help get people off the streets and help them achieve their full potentials, that they'd be falling over themselves to, how can we help? But instead it was like, oh, well, you have to do da-da-da-da. So finally, the San Francisco Salvation Army has pivoted. And interestingly, I believe a lot of the cultural change that's happened here in the Bay Area over the past 5 years resulted in the election of Daniel Lurie, who's probably the first moderate mayor we've had for many years. And he has been taking a recovery-based model. And the Salvation Army has been able to open two new abstinence-based programs for the first time in the history of the city. And then it is in partnership in two others. So that's opened up 500 new sober living beds with programming that are helping people transform their lives and go on to that. So that's what's happened with what we were talking about in the documentary. Another question is coming regarding that the approach needs to be regional. Certainly if we solve that, as Lawrence was saying, many of these horrifying numbers, an 80% increase in Oakland. So if we solve it in San Francisco, we certainly haven't solved it around the Bay. And you can kind of play whack-a-mole of getting rid of encampments here, but they just pop up there. And we've been working very diligently on creating a regional coalition these past several years. We have now a delegation of 50 electeds and nonprofits, service providers, and others going with us to Visit Haven and other facilities in Texas next month. And we're working on bringing together a regional coalition that will, if not align around a model, will at least start coordinating on our efforts. So I'm very optimistic about where we're going to get with that and look forward to keeping people updated. So thank you for your interest in that. Next question. We probably addressed the housing cost question. So I think we'll do that. Okay. And this is, so, you know, often people come in, and we've had here in San Francisco, under Mayor Lynn Breed and now under Mayor Dan Lurie, a crackdown on drug markets and a crackdown on encampments, and so on. And that's all very well and good. But, you know, in the absence of, where do people go if you just close encampments, and what happens to people when you just closed drug markets? Is that going to solve the problem? Anybody?
No, I think obviously it's not going to solve the problem. I mean, I've heard the analogy of marbles in a box. If you marbles on this side of the box, you change the box, they move to the other side. So you can't just clear encampments without other solutions. And in my mind, it's unethical to tell people that they can't stay on the street when there's no place else to go. So the criminalization of homelessness is shameful.
And I've always been concerned, you know, if you just shut down drug markets and you don't have recovery options available to people, you know, what are you asking them to do? And here in California, especially because recovery detox has gotten cartelized under Medi-Cal, under Obamacare. And so if somebody does hopefully decide that they do want to enter recovery, right now, if they present themselves, they're told, well, we have to do an assessment for Medi-Cal to cover the cost of taking you through this program. And we can't do it right now, so come back in a couple of days. Well, people who have chosen to go into recovery will change their mind within a couple of days. And we have indeed seen the numbers of people entering recovery plummet as a result. The Salvation Army now has opened up recovery on demand, but we need more of that, that if somebody is saying, well, you know, getting drugs or being on drugs or whatever has gotten too difficult, I guess I will try recovery. We have to have that path into recovery immediately and quickly and conveniently open, as well as you say, Scott, if you tear down the encampment, you need to have an option for someplace else for people to go. They don't just disappear.
Yeah, Mary, that was a game changer at Haven because, you know, we had a fair number of people that were suffering with addiction and mental illness. So we put on the campus what's called the Restoration Center. So it's detox and sobering beds and a mental health crisis unit. So when somebody says, I'm ready to get off drugs or alcohol, or I'm ready to deal with my mental illness, instead of getting in a police car and driving to find a bed somewhere, we can take them by the hand, walk them across the street, and get immediate intervention. Because when somebody, we have to be ready when they're ready, and it can't be a 3-day wait or a 5-day wait for the next bed that becomes available, because that just leads to relapse.
Scott, I'm going to stay with you. I have another question. You have worked with young adults exiting the foster system, and of course we see that that's a large percentage of them, unfortunately, do become homeless or go into end up incarcerated because they don't have a community or a family in which to live. Have there been programs or areas that have had greater success in getting young adults off the street? And can you tell us something about it?
So I worked 10 years with Casey Family Programs, and we did a lot of work with young adults emancipating from foster care. One of the models that we built was a community center, a drop-in center for young adults emancipating from care. It was kind of like a Haven for Hope, but a far smaller scale. But it was a place for young adults to go that didn't have parents, didn't have other resources, that they could get something to eat, they could get support, they could look for jobs, housing. We did multiple housing programs. So all those same kind of components. And it was interesting, this was years ago, but there was a stat at the time that the average child didn't leave the home until age 26 and was not financially self-sufficient until 29. And we expect an 18-year-old that with multiple placements and years of trauma to be self-sufficient automatically when they're 18. It was just ludicrous.
But I wouldn't think it would take I think it would be a less challenging population than the, you know, many of the chronically homeless. So it ought to be a programming that could be more easily developed and would be an easier population to assist than some of the people who have had years and years on the street and they now have multiple issues that have to be resolved.
So there's beginning to be a lot more programming around that particular issue. Haven for Hope recently opened a wing for young adults, particularly for that reason. You know, 18 to 24 year olds, you want them to learn good habits, not necessarily bad habits. And so they they cordoned off a section of the campus specifically for these young adults and for their particular needs, which often are different than people that have been chronically homeless on the street for 15 years. Some of it's just support and guidance to find the right path.
Regarding the issue of, I'm staying with you, Scott, sorry, but so many of these questions are best addressed by you. Thank you. The issue of silos, and that comes up a lot. I mean, we've heard that literally hundreds of cities have sent delegations to Haven for Hope. Yeah, very few are actually adapting its model. I think Las Vegas and now Salt Lake City are rare exceptions, but most do not. And again, the challenge that we're hoping to overcome here locally with our coalition is how to develop the political will and break down the silos that do exist. I mean, everybody parrots the silo issue all the time. Everybody's in silos. Nobody's talking to each other. So how can we do it?
Well, in San Antonio, it took a prominent business person, Mr. Bill Greehy, who was the founder of Haven for Hope. He was also a huge philanthropist here. So many of the nonprofits got money from his foundation. So he had some leverage to be able to bring them together. But the co-location, before Haven, we had silos throughout the community. And then when we opened Haven, what I found, we had a large building called the Transformation Center, which was kind of the hub for social services. What I found when that opened is we took all the silos from across the city and put them in one building. So we, with great intentionality, started doing training for all the partners on evidence-based practices. And again, like I said before, getting everybody to row in the same direction and then really putting the focus on the people and recovery. So too often we put more stock in programs than we do in serving the people. And that's why a person-centered approach is so important. And I think over the years, we got buy-in. It wasn't, in some ways, Haven was a shotgun wedding when it opened, but it really has changed and improved. And we now have extremely strong partnerships, not only among the nonprofits, but also among all the other systems that are involved, to include the courts and EMS and PD and all of those that now don't see it as a nonprofit or a government problem. It is a community problem, and it has to come from a community solution.
Yeah, I was so struck when a couple of members of the San Antonio Police Department who were moonlighting at Haven is in security, because Haven is an incredibly secure campus, both keeping those 1,700 people who are on campus safe, and then also ensuring that the surrounding community doesn't have the spillover effects that we've certainly seen from so many government-run facilities here, where they just don't take care of the people in their care at all, and you have horrible spillover effects to the neighborhood. So Haven is such a model in that. But talking to the police officers, and I asked them, you know, what have you learned by working here? And they, in unison, they said compassion, that working with that population had taught them how to relate to people who, as they put it, maybe having a bad day, are off their meds or otherwise. So when they're back out in the general population and they run into somebody who might be having a psychotic incident or otherwise be having a problem, they know how to talk to them, as they put it, that we know how to talk to them. We don't just throw handcuffs on them and take them to jail. And I think that's just, that's another example of that virtuous circle back out into the community. Chris and Lawrence, back to housing. And Chris also just produced a study on the NIMBY movement, not in my backyard, movement of people, which is a huge problem here. We not only have very bad housing policies here in California, and of course many other places, but I think also universal, maybe not a universal problem, but a major problem everywhere, is the not in my backyard of those who have and are happy in their houses and their neighborhoods, don't want anybody else to come in and build anything, so they block that kind of movement. Are there ways of pushing through that, do we think?
The NIMI phenomena is difficult to overcome because it is at least to a large degree a grassroots phenomenon. You do have some top-down elements of it, especially with environmental organizations that push for or push to block housing and organize these protests and lobby for anti-development laws. But it's also largely a cultural thing. Some of it's driven by misconception. There's a lot of, especially among low-income NIMBYs, is a very interesting phenomenon because they'll protest developments because they believe it will raise the cost of their rent when all evidence suggests otherwise. And that's rooted back in the old urban renewal policies where the government was destroying low-income housing with the promises of building new ones, and those promises weren't fulfilled. They would build stadiums and stuff instead a lot of times. And so in that environment, of course, you did see housing prices going up, but that's kind of carried forward to now just any development is seen as a threat of housing costs. So you have to overcome these problems, and there's more than policy that does that. But the best solution for this, I think, is Lawrence's solution, which is a right to build amendment to the state constitution. The reason I like this is because it actually, it's a solution that parallels a similar phenomena that took place in the 19th century back when you had to form a corporation, a business corporation, you had to go and beg your legislature for approval, which was very discretionary, just like a lot of like permit approval processes today, right? You needed it to get that discretionary permission. And a lot of states combated this by, it led to corruption and privilege to political cronies and things like that. And so the solution to this was states started passing amendments to their constitutions or revising their constitutions to guarantee equal access to this institution, this business form. And Lawrence's right to build amendment works similarly. It says that you have to issue a permit to somebody who's code compliant with like fire and safety codes. As long as they're code compliant, you have to issue a permit. It's a prescription for ministerial permitting. So I shouldn't have stolen Lawrence's thunder there since it's his idea, but I love that solution.
No, it's okay, because I also love Lawrence's other suggestion, which I'll ask him to tell us about himself, of how developers could partner with possible NIMBY objectors, such as home associations. So, Lawrence, tell us about that idea.
Oh, I think you're referring to, well, this is from my own experience where I lived in a homeowners association in Sacramento, and a drugstore wanted to build a drugstore within our HOA area. And, normally everybody would probably say no to that because they're not going to benefit directly and financially themselves. But what we did is we allowed them to buy their way into the HOA by providing a payment to the HOA, which kept our monthly homeowners associations due constant the entire time I lived there, which was about 8 years. And they never went up because we got this nice contribution from, I think it was a Walgreens or a CVS, I forget which. But again, like HOAs and other kind of covenant communities are a great way to solve some of these problems because they establish property rights. Everybody buys into the notion of the contract, and the contract is very explicit about what everybody is required to do. And through joint operation of the HOA, we keep everybody's property values up and the neighborhood from deteriorating. And so people tend to like these solutions, and they also create that incentive for people not necessarily to say no when somebody wants to build something in the HOA area. Because right now, if you live in, for example, the Sunset District in San Francisco, which is way to the west, and somebody wants to build a development in Soma, for example, which is more kind of in the eastern side of the city, what's your incentive to say yes to that? Because all you can think of is all the downsides of it: more traffic, more people, more problems with schools and housing and this and that. So what you want to do is create an incentive for people to say yes. And this is one way of doing it, is kind of give everybody a payoff through the HOA if something comes, once if some developer wants to build something in that area. We have a book called The Voluntary City, which has a chapter on how you can convert your typical neighborhood into an HOA. There is a process for doing it, and I think it would go a long way to solving some of these community problems that we see and the inability to build. But again, I think the right to work, the right to build amendment that I propose is probably the most direct way of doing it. It's basically creating a by right permitting for people to build what they want to on private property as long as it doesn't physically harm others and that it abides by certain fire and sanitation code requirements. It would shift the power, the balance of power, you know, towards property owners and away from NIMBYs. And one question I actually had for Scott is, how did Haven overcome NIMBYism in San Antonio? Did they have like a long process of community discussions where people could offer suggestions for ways to solve the problem or how to avoid the problem? Like, what did that look like in San Antonio?
So it was interesting. I mean, there certainly was some NIMBYism, and it kind of hit home about year two. We started getting a lot of complaints from the neighbors about Haven being there, and we recognized that we really hadn't effectively engaged the neighbors. So we invited all of the adjacent neighborhoods to come on the campus, and we did listening sessions. What we heard from the neighbors is we shouldn't just be warehousing these people. We should be helping them with life skills and employment skills and mental health and all these things that we were already doing, but we hadn't communicated effectively to the neighborhood. Out of that, we created a group of volunteer group of people. Forget the name of that we gave it, but we had volunteers from the campus that went into the neighborhood, did trash cleanup, built ramps, wheelchair ramps for nonprofits, and did a lot of work. The beauty of that was we had neighbors working side by side with people experiencing homelessness, and they didn't know that these people were experiencing homelessness. So it really kind of changed the way the neighborhood looked at people experiencing homelessness. So it was a positive for the neighbors and a positive for Haven.
I think it's called community ambassadorship.
Yes, that's it.
Ambassadors.
Ambassadors.
Yeah. We're going to have to wrap it up, but Chris, if it's something real quick.
Oh, I was just going to say, for people who hate HOAs, Lawrence's solution can be met with private deed restrictions as well, which don't have fees and are more lightly regulated. This is what Houston, which has no zoning codes, uses to regulate neighborhood character. So there are other options for people like me who hate HOAs.
Okay. Well, on that note, we have a lot more questions. I'm sorry we couldn't get to them all. This was a very high-level overview of what's in the book. I do encourage you to get the book when it's released next month and enjoy it. It's not a heavy book. It's a quick read and covers a lot of subjects, I think, quite well, if I do say so myself. We do have the companion documentary, if you haven't seen it, Beyond Homeless, Finding Hope, which is all on our website, beyondhomeless.org. We are also continuing to document our ongoing efforts to create a community coalition here in San Francisco. And as we make progress with that, we want that to be a model for other communities to be able to hopefully do the same there. Above all, what we're trying to do is create community and have people come together in your own community and realize that by working together, you can resolve not only homelessness, but other issues of concern to you and your neighbors. So we hope you will keep an eye on what we're doing. We'll try to keep updates coming of examples of, you know, real world examples of how this is happening. If you had a question today that was not addressed, I welcome you to send in an email. You can send an email to info@beyondhomeless.org. That comes to me, and I will either answer it or I'll give it to one of our fellows to give you a better answer. We very much appreciate your being with us today. This has been recorded, so if there are others with whom you want to share it, we encourage you to. Thank you all to our participants today, Lawrence, Scott, Chris, and Jonathan. And thank you all who joined us from the wide world. Take care. Good day.